Dan Murphy, when you were in college and a young man, what was your go-to late-night snack at your dining hall?
We had the Sparrows in the basement of the student union. There was always the long line, so sometimes you get away with the five-finger discount slice of pizza at 1 a.m. That was probably my go-to.
Did you know somebody who worked there? How did you get away with that?
Yeah, you have to have a connection in the dining hall. That's the hookup.
I personally went to a school where something called toasted rolls were the delicacy of choice. It was kind of like a long, extended horizontal powdered donut with a lot of sugar sprinkled on top. So you can imagine I enjoyed that quite a bit as a young man. This, of course, is important because Dartmouth, their men's basketball team, took a step forward in U.S. labor relations that we've never seen before. And it all started because of one kid in a late night dining hall.
Yeah, Cade Haskins, starting what, or moving forward at least, what could be a revolution in college sports thanks to his after-school, after-practice job at the dining hall at Dartmouth. Cade is a junior forward. He's from Minnesota. He's probably not the guy that was ever thinking basketball was going to be his career beyond college sports. He works two part-time jobs. He's doing this more as a way to play the sport he loves and add a little bit to his college experience. More so than what we would think of as a lot of big-time college basketball players.
The day that college administrators have long dreaded has finally arrived. Last week, the Dartmouth men's basketball team officially formed the first ever union in college sports. And though it may prove to only be a union in name, it is a watershed moment for universities across the country. So today, our Dan Murphy explains what it all means and why the professionalization of college athletes looks ready to go into hyperdrive. I'm Clint Yates. It's Wednesday, March 13th. This is ESPN Daily. Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured, it was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo, another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky, 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely. Please do tell us when and how you first learned of this unionization moment and what your reaction was.
About a week ago, the news came across, and frankly, there wasn't a whole lot of drama in it.
The men's basketball team at Dartmouth has voted to unionize. This is a major step towards organizing the first labor union for college athletes and a direct attack on how the NCAA does business.
The players have indicated since last September that they were interested in forming this union. We had a pretty good idea what the vote was going to look like, and they even played a game that night, and not a whole lot changed from one game versus to the next for them. But again, it is a moment worth highlighting in the history of college sports. I kind of think of the way that amateurism is dwindling away in college sports as this excruciatingly long road trip. And Dartmouth's vote was sort of like crossing a state line in that analogy. You're still on the same road. You're still surrounded by the same kind of boring surroundings. But it is a reminder that the landscape is changing and that makes you step back and think, oh, wow, these guys we're actually going to get to the destination where we're headed. And that's, I think, where college athletes are right now, that there is still unknown road ahead and they're not there yet. But it's safe to say at this point that in one form or another, some NCAA athletes are soon going to be considered professionals.
Speaking of unknown roads, there's a lot of people that might say the same thing about Dartmouth, a school in New Hampshire, live free or die, whatever. People don't know a ton about this program. So help me understand a little bit about who they are. What kind of a program are they? What kind of a team are we actually talking about here, Dan?
There's some irony in the fact that the group that might bring professionalization to college sports is about as amateur as one could think of in Division I basketball. Dartmouth hasn't been to an NCAA tournament since 1959. They haven't had a winning season while any of these players have ever been alive. They are in dead last this year. They finished their season in dead last this year in the Ivy League, which on its own is one of the least sort of professionalized leagues in college sports. They are the only Division I league that doesn't offer scholarships.
They don't offer scholarships, so kids playing there are in a little bit of a different situation than somebody that goes to a big state school or really even just any other school for that matter that's playing sports at the collegiate level.
Yeah, I think in general, the Ivy Leagues are built a little bit different than a lot of college sports. They aren't the ACC, Big Ten, SEC schools that you're going to see in the Final Four here coming up in a few weeks. They aren't turning big profits. You know, they do make some money in a variety of ways. But really, the Dartmouth men's basketball team and a lot of the programs on Ivy League campuses are there for the reason that we hear athletic directors talking about so much. They want to build a little bit more of a campus culture, and it's supposed to enrich the education of a lot of the athletes on campus.
So that means that money that supports the program, where does it come from? Student fees, tuition? It's obviously not big-time sponsors or NIL or anything like that related to what's happening.
It's, yeah, some students' fees. There are, you know, some dollars that flow through the NCAA down to these schools. Donors obviously always play a big role in this. But again, that money is coming through Dartmouth because they see college sports as, one, a marketing tool, right? It helps bring alumni back to campus and get recruits interested in having that around, but also in just kind of building out the educational experience of athletes in the same kind of way that same reasons you have a school play or an orchestra on campus. That's the kind of role that college sports are playing in a place like Dartmouth.
I bring all that up to say this thus makes it a very particular place for a union to get started amongst college athletes. Please do explain how Cade Haskins got into this from the jump.
Cade Haskins is a junior forward. He has about 25 minutes of playing time this season, so he's not a key player on the campus, but he did spend his times after practice, as we talked about, working at a snack bar. And it just so happens that a couple of years ago, the student workers at that snack bar decided they wanted to unionize as labor movements kind of grew across college campuses over the past few years. And so when that was going on, he learned about the benefits of being in a union, the increased pay, the better treatment that workers can get in those kind of situations, and was learning about the labor movement in college sports. And I think the two things stuck together for him, and he started talking to his teammates this past offseason and decided they should give it a try themselves.
What went on from there? I can imagine that being reasonably smart kids, it is Ivy League. What happens when he goes to his teammates with this idea from the beginning?
So yeah, this past September, all 15 members of the men's basketball team came together and signed their union authorization cards. And shortly thereafter, they filed a complaint saying that Dartmouth was not following the labor laws properly and being able to negotiate with them. And that tipped off this case, which came to a conclusion in early February. We should probably note here too, Clinton, that this is all coming on the heels of these players paying attention of a few years ago. The general counsel of a group called the National Labor Relations Board, that oversees private labor in the United States, published a letter to saying that they didn't feel college athletes were being treated fairly by their schools. And this letter essentially amounted to an invitation for anyone in college sports to form a union, knowing that they'd have the backing of this group. And it took a few years, but that's where Dartmouth players ended up landing.
What changed? Why hadn't this happened before in regards to the NLRB?
It has gone up a little bit back and forth over time. There's been a few other efforts like this in the past decade. But I think in general, we've seen public sentiment change pretty significantly in the past 5 to 10 years about how college athletes are being treated and how much of a business college sports has become.
What are some of those other efforts? I seem to recall Northwestern had a situation like this, but that was at least a decade ago, if my off-the-top memory serves me right.
Northwestern was definitely the big one. That was back in 2014 when some of their football players got together and decided to form a union. And they got somewhat down the tracks. They got to a place where they were in front of an NLRB hearing, and the regional director there also believed them to be employees. But they didn't get quite as far as Dartmouth has gotten now, where the players didn't publicly hold an election and weren't able to state out loud that they wanted to unionize and wanted to be treated as employees.
Did anybody on Dartmouth's campus who were not the team think this was a good idea at the time?
I don't know that anybody on campus really loves this idea, or at least anybody leading the university in an administrative role loves this idea. Certainly during the hearing, we heard plenty of athletic department employees and other people in positions of power at the university fight against this. And they're still fighting against this. And I think there was sort of an attitude of sort of like, seriously, here at Dartmouth, like, look around. We aren't Duke. We're not Kansas. This is not what we're trying to do here. I think that attitude still persists. But, in general, this is the players sort of paying attention to the way the wind's blowing in college sports and deciding somebody's got to be the first one to step up and try to push this conversation forward as far as athletes being employees. And it just so happens to be these guys at Dartmouth were the ones to do it.
Well, that's the thing. Duke, North Carolina, any other school you want to name, they give out scholarships. That is presumably some form of return, payment, whatever you want to call it, for the players. And typically, that's a crucial step in getting union recognition from the NLRB, is that there is no payment being made as they play a role in who gets to unionize and who doesn't. Was the no scholarships element a large part of the reason for the unionization being something that was going to be ultimately looked at as sensible?
I think a more fair compensation is something that the players are asking for. I know some of the guys said after their game, after their vote, they wanted wages. They wanted to push for something that looks more like a scholarship. But, you know, in terms of the NLRB's rules and how this is looked at, in order to be considered an employee under that part of the law, you basically have to receive some form of compensation in exchange for work that your employer has some control over how it's performed. And in this case, the way that played out was Dartmouth's compensation for those players was considered to be some of the free gear they get, some of the extra training they get, preferential treatment of getting accepted a little bit earlier into programs. And, you know, in exchange for the amount of control that a coach has over what classes they take and when they have to show up for practice. And so, well, yeah, they're not getting the million-dollar deals that somebody at Kansas or Duke might be with NIL right now. Just the fact that they're getting free socks from the athletic department was enough for the NLRB to consider them employees.
Can't eat free socks, but I do get the point there. Let's set the stage for the union election amongst the team last week. 15 players, it was not unanimous, they voted 13-2 to join the local service employee union, the same one that had organized said student cafeteria workers. Dartmouth, of course, has continued to fight this and immediately filed an appeal. What happens next and how does this process play out for those of us who aren't intimately familiar with labor relations?
These things are going to move really slowly. There's a very good chance that Cade Haskins and all of his upperclassmen teammates are finished with their college basketball careers by the time this reaches a resolution. As you mentioned, Dartmouth has appealed the ruling. That means it's going to go to the National Labor Relations Board, who's going to make a decision on whether or not they agree with what the regional director has decided in naming these guys employees. And even after that goes through, if it's ruled in favor of the players, Dartmouth has the option of taking this to federal court and eventually to the Supreme Court. So we might end up years down the road before the Supreme Court has the final say in what's going to happen here.
You know, that's fascinating because it means that guys like Cade are basically fighting for something that they're never going to see the benefits of. Why is it that you think they're motivated thus in order to keep this effort alive?
From what they said, frankly, it's about doing something to change the system for the next generation. They feel that college athletes have been exploited. That's what Cade talked about after they made their vote last week. And I think that's a sentiment that we see growing in popularity across all of college sports in the last decade or so. It's a big difference from where we were 10 years ago when Northwestern was trying to do the same thing. There are a handful of different routes that we're seeing right now for athletes like Cade Haskins and their advocates to try to push schools to share more and treat them more fairly. Unionization is definitely a big one. But I think, you know, even Dartmouth players will probably agree they don't have the bargaining power they need necessarily to force their school to negotiate with them. In general, this is a way to continue shifting the conversation forward and hoping that at some point we land at a point where athletes are just getting a bigger piece of the pie for what they help create in college sports.
Coming up, we take a look at what the prospect of unions means for the future of college sports. Delicious meat, nutritious. In the snack that packs a real protein punch, Wonderful Pistachios, one of the highest protein nuts out there. Each 1 ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, giving you over 10% of your daily value. Trust me, I've been eating them like there's no tomorrow all week. Wonderful Pistachios also come in a variety of flavors and sizes, perfect for enjoying with your family and friends or taking them with you on the go. And you, like me, are on the go a lot. Taking the kids to school, hopping from meeting to meeting, shopping for groceries, whatever it may be. Well, the good news is, not only are Wonderful Pistachios a complete protein providing all 9 essential amino acids, they're also great for all your adventures. So whether you're a pistachio purist who loves cracking open every nut, or you prefer the convenience of no-shells pistachios, Wonderful Pistachios has got you covered. Grab Wonderful Pistachios and elevate your snack game today. Visit WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more. When you're on a business trip, you know what completely goes off the rails? Your workout routine, especially when you book a hotel that doesn't have a gym. So what ends up happening is you do a few push-ups and sit-ups in your room, run around the block, or just skip it entirely. Lame. If you just stay at La Quinta by Wyndham, you'll discover there's a fully equipped fitness center at every location. Now you can wake up and power your buys and tries the right way or de-stress with some cardio. The choice is yours. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com. Of course, it is very striking that the NLRB found that these Dartmouth players are considered employees of the university because theoretically, if they can be considered employees at Dartmouth, then there's no doubt that players at schools like you named, Duke and Kansas, could and maybe will be considered the same. But let's think about this as a thought exercise. Are there any other schools or groups that you could see using this same logic to collectively bargain again down the line?
Well, we don't even need to be hypothetical about it, Clint. There are cases like this already in action right now. And I think the biggest one worth watching is happening out in Los Angeles right now, where there's an advocacy group that is on behalf of USC players filed a claim that those athletes aren't just employees of their school, but also of their conference and the NCAA itself. And I think it's important that we take a step back and look at that case too. One of the key differences between what happened, let's say, at Northwestern 10 years ago and at Dartmouth is that the Ivy League is all full of private schools. The NLRB only has jurisdiction over private companies in America. So if players at schools like the University of Kansas or Michigan or Ohio State, which are public institutions, want to unionize, they'd have to go through a much different process. So this USC case is really important because it's trying to prove that conferences and the NCAA themselves are employees of these athletes, which would make it easier for every college player across the country to be considered an employee, unlike the Dartmouth case where it's really restricted to just private school athletes.
Vanderbilt, looking at you right there, only private school in the SEC, not a ton of private schools littering Power Five conferences, but that is, again, why SC matters in this particular case. Are those two cases really enough to change the landscape writ large? Is there another step that could make the college athlete employee more of a constant? Is it a federal one? Is it a state one? How do you see that working out?
Dartmouth on its own probably isn't enough. The USC case, if it falls the right way, will certainly add to pressure. There are a handful of really big federal lawsuits that are also in the process of slowly working their way through this court system. One of them basically asking for college athletes to get paid a minimum wage. Others asking for back pay from some of the revenue sharing that they say they're owed from broadcasting deals. All of those things are potentially game changing. I don't know that any one of them on their own is the item that's going to be the dagger that kills the NCAA. But in a way, all of those threats add up to be more than the sum of their parts, and that they continue to be evidence and loud alarm bells to everyone in charge of college sports, letting them know they really need to change their ways, that the current system is not going to work. And if they don't want the courts or maybe even Congress to tell them how college sports is going to look in the future, they need to start being proactive, which is something that they've been remiss on in the past 10 years. And so I think, especially when we look at the Dartmouth case, as much as anything, it is cranking up the volume on those alarm bells that should be going off inside every athletic department in the country, letting them know that the current status quo is no longer acceptable.
At least NCAA football is back. People are really excited about that.
You can thank your name, image, likeness for that. And maybe one day there'll be a union to negotiate what those fees are for the players.
I think a lot of average college sports fans look at a situation like this and they say, okay, well, what's the actual harm in having your players unionized? I don't think most people understand that even at the biggest schools, it is not the schools that are paying the athletes any of the monies that they would be getting otherwise from anybody. So why would you say it is an imperative for most of these schools to try to keep the status quo in terms of how they manage their athletes on campus?
Right now, the stance of the NCAA and every school in it, for the most part, is that college athletes are not employees of their schools. They very much want to avoid that. In fact, I think that's the hill that a lot of athletic administrators are willing to die on as amateurism kind of erodes over the past 10 years. They want to avoid issues with like paying workers' comp, or what does it mean if you're not living up to the demands of your job? Can you fire a college athlete at that point? What about Title IX implications of those type of things? Those are a lot of the alarm bells we hear from athletic directors and coaches when we start talking about employment. But because it's so hard for athletes to press their schools for more, unions have been seen as one of the main ways that they can make progress in trying to get more from their schools.
You recently sat down with new NCAA president Charlie Baker. How would you characterize his take on these recent unionization efforts?
Baker is, like his colleagues and the people he represents, strongly against college athletes being considered employees. But I will say what was interesting in our conversation a couple weeks ago with Charlie Baker was he mentioned that he's not necessarily against the idea of athletes getting together and collectively asking for more, whether that's formally through a union process or as something like a players association where they're not considered employees.
What do you think about the future of collective bargaining or athletes organizing, even if it's not as a union, into some sort of players association?
I think those sorts of things can be enormously positive. I mean, part of the reason we have SACs in the first place is to get advice and guidance from the voice of the student athlete about, I'll give you a good example of where sports betting. They were the first ones who started talking to me about the concerns they had about sports betting generally. And they were the first ones who started saying to us, you should think differently about how some of the penalties work, how some of the rules work, and we need a lot more educational support coming from the campuses and coming from you to help us understand how to communicate and protect our classmates, who are student athletes, from getting in trouble on this stuff. I mean, their voices as an association, as a council, they're really important.
The idea of collectively bargaining, he said, could be, quote, enormously positive, which is a pretty big change in tone from what we're used to hearing from people in positions like Charlie Baker's.
Yeah, specifically his predecessor, Mark Emmert, yeah?
Definitely. Emmert was far away from where Baker is. And I think, again, another sign of the changing times. The people in the NCAA realize that they are going to have to give more to college athletes. And while, again, they don't want them to become employees, they're right now searching for some creative ways to try to potentially bargain with athletes moving forward.
What are some of the things you've seen in terms of schools and their shifting attitudes? And even, as you mentioned, with the NCAA potentially looking at the legal relationship between schools and their athletes, have you seen anything that you've noticed in your travels as a journalist?
You know, over the past few years, as name, image, and likeness deals have really changed the shape of college sports, we've seen a market pop up for college athlete talent. And in a lot of ways, that's changed the way that the schools themselves think about how they're going to be involved in that marketplace. They want to get more involved. Right now, it's boosters and collectives and third parties that are the ones paying athletes and really influencing where an athlete is going to go to school. That's not something schools are comfortable with. And so they are in many ways trying to get more involved. But when you talk to coaches and even some athletic directors now, more and more, they see the wisdom in being able to negotiate some kind of deal with their athletes, right? The reason that we don't have free agency every year in the NFL or the NBA is because there are collective bargaining agreements with the Players Association that lock them into place with contracts a little bit stronger. They have ways to control things like the way the transfer portal is working in college sports right now. And frankly, there are more and more people in positions of power of college sports that are starting to see the wisdom in having something like a Players Association. For the last several decades, schools have been able to really keep their feet in two different lanes. In one case, they are and act like a multi-billion dollar entertainment industry. And when it's more convenient, they act like and talk like this education-based campus enrichment club. And I think what we can learn from the Dartmouth case is now more than ever, those schools are going to have to choose one of those two lanes. And the biggest, richest schools will find it hard to leave this really lucrative business. Others, potentially like Dartmouth, may actually take more of a step back from the unique way college sports have evolved in America. So it's going to be different. We don't know exactly how it's going to look yet, but it's going to be really fascinating to see how it all plays out.
The transfer portal offers a whole other dimension, if you will, of discussion as to why all of this kind of works together in terms of whatever free market means, never mind labor and employees and so on and so forth. And the reason I bring that up is because I've always contended that NIL and all of these forms of structured payments for athletes, it was always going to help sort of those mid-tier sport people like soccer players, volleyball players, baseball players, more so than it was ever going to help like a big time basketball player, what have you. Where do you think this goes in terms of what's most able to be implemented and also what makes the most sense for both sides and everybody involved?
I think all of it helps, even those athletes at the top. you know, clearly they've got more money in their pockets than they did a few years ago. In that sense, it's more for athletes than it used to be. But I think more importantly, it's shifted the conversation. There was always this fear that no one was going to care about college sports anymore if athletes started making a few bucks, that the whole system was going to fall apart and the sky was going to start falling. And even now, a few years into this, there are issues. It is not stable and sustainable where it is now, but the sky isn't falling. And I think every time we see that, we move a little bit closer to getting to something that looks a little bit more professional. And what a lot of these athlete advocates are saying is a lot more fair. We talk about the unionization case. We can talk about some of the other lawsuits that are going on in college sports right now. But all of them are just different pressure points as the walls are sort of closing in on this business model that the NCAA has had for the past 100 years.
The school you went to, Notre Dame, also a school that's in that interesting big school, yet a private institution as well. They're a particularly interesting example because they have their own television contract as well. And I'm asking you to speak a little bit personally here. Do you think your school is one that you could see perhaps adopting a model like this in the future for their student athletes?
Yeah, for sure. They're an interesting one because they don't have the same conference ties as a lot of other groups. And I think we may see a future in which it makes sense for athletes to negotiate with their conference as a group. Right? A lot of the conversation about what unions look like in the future is what's a logical group that these players can make. It's probably too big of a union to have every college football player in the same group negotiating for the same thing. They have very varied interests and different market power and that type of thing. And it's too big of a union to think that college football and basketball and field hockey and swimmers should all be in the same group. So how this gets broken up in the future is really interesting. And Notre Dame is an interesting piece of that, right? If this is going to be a school by school thing, that it might end up working out pretty well for the Irish.
That could get you a lot of sparrows. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you.
You can watch Dan's interview with NCAA President Charlie Baker on ESPN's YouTube channel. A link is available in the show notes. I'm Clinton Yates. This has been ESPN Daily. We'll talk to you tomorrow, kiddos.